This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We're now a couple days, just about, removed from Election Day. We still don't know for certain who the next president will be. As of right now, the Associated Press and NPR count former Vice President Joe Biden is having 264 electoral votes, and President Donald Trump currently having 214. Ballots continue to be counted in Arizona, Nevada, Georgia, North Carolina, and Pennsylvania, all states that could help sway this election one way or the other. We are also seeing a pretty steady stream of tweets from the president, several of which have been labeled by that social media company as being disputed or misleading. Donald Trump tweeted a couple of hours ago in all caps, quote, "Stop the count." He also tweeted about what he called a big legal win in Pennsylvania about an hour ago. I believe that's a reference to a decision by a court in that state to allow more access to the area where the votes are being counted in Pennsylvania by members of the Trump campaign. And just 45 minutes ago, the president tweeted, quote, "All of the recent Biden claimed states will be legally challenged by us for voter fraud and state election fraud. Plenty of proof. Proof. Just check out the media. We will win. America first." Those are the words of President Donald Trump in a tweet that has been censored by Twitter, as some or all of the content shared in this tweet is disputed and might be misleading about an election or other civic process. We are joined today by Washington Post senior editor Mark Fisher. He joins us via Zoom. Mark, thank you for being with us.
It's great to be with you, Michael.
Our pleasure to have you. We also have the executive director and chief counsel at Equal Citizens, Jason Harrow. He also joins us by Zoom. Jason, welcome to the program.
Great to be here.
And as a note to our listeners, you heard our promos probably advertising that the political junkie Ken Rudin would be making an earlier than usual appearance with us, earlier in the month than usual anyway. And due to some internal technical difficulties, that's not happening today, we have to say regrettably. So we will not have Ken Rudin with us, but we are going to work on scheduling a special Ken Rudin appearance very soon. We know how much you enjoy when he comes on and how authoritative and interesting he can be, but we're going to work on getting that rescheduled. In the meantime, we are grateful to have Mark and Jason with us. And Mark, I want to start with you. These tweets from the president are unusual. It's not unusual for us to talk about the unusual nature of the way the president communicates. What are you seeing right now when you look at what the president is putting out there in relation to the election and the integrity of this election? What are you seeing?
Well, we're seeing confusion, we're seeing provocation, we're seeing the rage and fulminations of a president who realizes that he's on the verge of losing his bid for a second term. The numbers are not looking good for Donald Trump, and he's doing what he always does when he is in a difficult position, when he is faces the prospect of losing, and that is to lash out, to blame, to claim that things are rigged. He laid the groundwork for this at least 6 months ago and throughout his campaign, when he said that he would win this election unless it was rigged. And later on, he said it was rigged. And so before, during, and now after the election, we have those kinds of pronouncements from Donald Trump, who puts little thought into what the long-term impact of a president demeaning the validity and honesty of our electoral system can be. But in the immediate situation, it's a way of rallying his base and a way of unsettling the count and diminishing trust and confidence in the eventual outcome.
Mark, those of us in the media, I shouldn't speak authoritatively about all of us in the media, but I know that a lot in the media, we did our best to prepare the electorate for what would be a stranger than usual election counting process, you know, that a lot of people would be voting by mail this time due to the COVID-19 pandemic. A lot of states that had never dealt with this manner of voting before might be slow to count them. But as the results go, there were either warnings or at least information provided that you would see perhaps some substantial dramatic swings from the Democratic column to the Republican column as certain types of votes, whether they be same day in person or absentee or mail in voting. As far as the electorate goes, Mark, Americans, do you think that the country just wasn't prepared enough for how these votes are being counted, and so people are possibly more easily swayed by the president's messaging here?
I don't think we're at that point yet. I think people are being quite patient. Look, we're an instant ratification society, and Election Day is one of those sort of high points of that instant gratification. We have been trained to expect lots of alerts and projections and results on election night. And yes, everybody did put out a lot of warnings and explanations that this election night would be different. And I think most Americans have taken that to heart and are willing to wait this out. It looks like it'll be just a matter of a few days. And, you know, just 20 years ago, we had an election night that lasted 37 days. And there were no riots in the streets, and there was no general uprising. There were people who got impatient. There was a CNN poll a month into that election count that found that 62% of Americans said they want this to just be over with, no matter what the result was. So people do and perhaps will get frustrated. But there's, despite people boarding up windows and shutting down stores on Tuesday night, we saw really peaceful responses to this election so far. And I think people understand that because of the pandemic, this time is different.
Our number is 513-419-7100. We'd love for you to join our conversation as well. Tell us what you're feeling right now, what you're observing, how you feel about what we know so far about the outcome of the election. You can call us anytime during the hour at 513-419-7100. We are joined today by Washington Post senior editor Mark Fisher. And also with us today is Jason Harrow. He's the executive director and chief counsel of Equal Citizens. Jason, we brought you on to help provide some context and explanation about these legal challenges to the outcome as they've been sought by the president's campaign. Before we dive into that, why don't you let us know what your organization is?
Sure. So it's called Equal Citizens. We have been working on issues related to presidential selection and the Electoral College for several years now. Most recently, we were involved in litigation regarding the role of presidential electors themselves. So listeners who follow the Supreme Court really closely may remember that there was a decision this summer about whether states could require presidential electors to vote for the candidate who received the most votes in the state. It was sort of a quirky little issue. I argued that case by phone in the U.S. Supreme Court. Ultimately, the Supreme Court held that electors will be required to follow the popular vote, which, you know, only matters every once in a while. But because of this scenario that some people are talking about, where we could have a 270-268 vote or a 269-269 tie, even, it turns out that decision in July may have some impact. But we've also been advocating and litigating and studying issues around presidential selection and the Electoral College more broadly as well.
So, Jason, the president, Donald Trump, just within the past hour, tweeted out, quote, "All of the recent Biden-claimed states will be legally challenged by us for voter fraud and state election fraud." He says there's plenty of proof. He cites the media as that proof. It says we will win America first. Jason, based on what you know so far about the Trump campaign's legal strategy here, what can we expect from the courts?
So I think we can expect an orderly accounting of any claims that are brought before the courts, just like they have always done in election disputes. And there is a disconnect between what the president is saying and what the campaign itself is doing. So let's go back a couple of nights ago. It feels so long ago, perhaps, to many folks, but when the president issued that extraordinary statement at 2:30 a.m. on Wednesday morning following the election, that he was going to go directly to the U.S. Supreme Court and stop the votes. That's not something that can happen. The U.S. Supreme Court has no way for a political candidate to just file a case that says, please stop the votes because why? Because I'm losing or because I'm winning, or that's not a thing. And indeed, it's not something that happened. So, okay, let's look at what has actually happened. The most common thing that he's filed are lawsuits in Philadelphia, in Michigan. Apparently, a new one is, they just held a press conference in Nevada to talk about poll observer, poll watcher access in Philadelphia and Michigan. They claim that they have not been able to observe the counting of these absentee ballots primarily. And they just got several of these cases have been rejected. They just got their first very, 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 very moderate win in Philadelphia, which said the Trump campaign poll observers can be allowed to observe within 6 feet of people counting ballots so long as they observe COVID protocols. So what's the impact of that? The impact of that has nothing to do with the count, nothing to do with stopping. It's just making sure that the procedure is going smoothly and is transparent. And there's no real evidence that it's not at all. We can talk about the bigger challenges that may be coming, but those aren't really quite on the table yet, despite the president's rhetoric.
That's Jason Harrow. He's the executive director and chief counsel of Equal Citizens. We're also joined today by Washington Post senior editor Mark Fisher. And Mark, you and some of your colleagues wrote a piece on Election Day about the way Americans are putting their trust in elections still. And part of that article reads in part, quote, "As the nation's unusually intense election season ended Tuesday, with millions of votes pouring in by mail and drop boxes and in person, Americans, perhaps paradoxically, put their faith in the system. For all of this era's unparalleled mistrust of government, of institutions, of each other, voting is an intrinsically hopeful act, a statement that things can get better and that the leader of the country matters." Do you think 2 days later, Mark, that those words still ring true?
I do. And I think that's why you see this sort of doom scrolling and addiction to the TV accounts of each new tranche of votes. I think this election matters deeply to a great many people. That's why we saw this unprecedented turnout. So, some of that is a negative vote. Some of that is people just wanting to get the president out or keep the Democrats out. But a lot of it is a belief that if their side wins, we may get a handle on some of the really egregious problems that we face. So, we're in this very strange place as a society where, on the one hand, we've lost a lot of the foundations of our trust, whether it be in the government, whether it be in our own communities and each other. And yet, at the same time, the political participation is off the charts, and people believe that this election was, every generation says this is the most important election of our lifetime. That's a kind of a mainstay of American politics. But this time, there was, as we saw, just in the way people took to the streets and the way people were willing to risk their health to go vote, in the way they were willing to vote in new ways, sometimes confusing ways, by mail at early voting centers. We saw a dedication to democracy and to voting that is a little shred of optimism in a fairly dark time.
We did see enormous turnout in states across the country this time around. And it was also interesting to see that right now, President Trump is trailing. I mean, if Joe Biden, according to the Associated Press's count, were to win Nevada, he'd have 270 electoral votes, defeating the incumbent president. But it was an otherwise surprisingly good night for Republicans. They had been predicted to meet doom in the U.S. Senate, lose more seats in the House, but that didn't happen. They've held on to control, as of now, it looks like, of the U.S. Senate, though there may be some races to be determined that could change that. But they picked up seats in the House. And so I'm wondering, Mark, if there's anything to take from the election as it relates to a referendum on President Trump, independent of the Republican Party as a whole.
I think this result, whether Biden or Trump ultimately prevails, makes clear that there is no consensus about the need to repudiate Donald Trump, that many, if not most, of Donald Trump's supporters stuck with him despite their own misgivings about his behavior. You go out and talk to a lot of Trump supporters and they will give you chapter and verse about how embarrassed or humiliated they are by his tweets, by his language, by his approach to the office. On the other hand, they like a lot of what he's done. They think their lives are better off now than they were 4 years ago. On the other side, you have in Joe Biden, someone who's promised a restoration of kind of decency and normalcy, a kind of swinging us back from the disruption of the Trump years. And that appealed to a lot of people, but again, no consensus. And so we remain pretty much where we were in 2016, a highly divided nation with an enormous body of people who have gone through a terribly tough time since 2008, since the economic collapse, who, because they've either lost jobs or their kids can't afford to stay in their communities and have a thriving life there, that there is a core foundational problems that neither party has addressed. And so the voters continue to reach out for people who are going to turn things upside down. And they did it with Barack Obama, and they did it with Donald Trump the first time, and they're sending that message again and again until maybe it one day is received.
You can join our conversation at Cincinnati Edition by emailing talk@wvxu.org or give us a call at 513-419-7100. Let's take a call now. We've got Gary on the line. Hi, Gary. What's your question or comment?
My question is here's my comment. Yesterday, one of the national news media, CBS or one of the others, it was reported that Deutsche Bank, if Trump loses the election, is going to call in their notes. And they try to sell them, and they can't sell them. Nobody wants them. The point is that this is no longer about his ego being president of the United States. It's about his economic well-being, because if and when he leaves the office of presidency, I read several articles that he probably will wind up in federal bankruptcy court in about 2 years. This is his political life. His ego, but more than anything, this is about his financial well-being. And all of a sudden, the things that are in play now are more than, you know, being president and his ego. His financial well-being, his house of cards, which I consider it to be, will collapse around him, and he knows it. And I think he's in the fight for his life.
Gary, thank you so much for listening, and thank you so much for sharing your perspective with us. We do appreciate it. Again, the number is 513-419-7100, or you can email your comment to talk@wvxu.org. I will take an email now. We've got one just in from Kevin in Mason, who writes, I'm old enough to remember when the 2012 elections took place. There were two, quote, Black Panthers with some sort of nightsticks at a polling location in Pennsylvania, and the right lost their collective minds. Contrast that with the threat of largely white male crowds wielding weapons in open carry states, and it's just another day in Trump's America. Where is the outrage? 513-419-7100 is the number to call. talk@wvxu.org is our email. Let's go back to the phones. Now I have John on the line. Hi, John. What's your question or comment?
Hi. I just wanted to point out, I always thought it was really interesting to see a certain group is very, very patriotic and seems to love America, but then seems to have no faith in the system itself. And I always found that interesting to observe.
Well, thank you for sharing that perspective with us, John. Thanks so much. Mark Fisher, let me turn over to you for that comment that John just offered as sort of this perceived contradiction in sentiment, whether someone is patriotic, loving the country, but so doubtful and distrustful of its systems. You wrote a column towards an article at the end of October that explored the way Americans look at the other side, the quote, other side of the political aisle, and how the future looks dark if that other side wins. Can you maybe expand upon that thought that John offered us based on that?
Yeah, I think we all kind of instinctively get that the tenor and tone of our political discussion has leached into so much else that goes on in our lives. And people used to be able to compartmentalize politics, and now it's so much a part of who we are that people are making decisions about who to talk to, who to be friends with, who to live near, based on whether they are aligned with us politically and culturally. That's something new in this country, and there's been almost a kind of self-segregation where we're hanging out with and living with and near people who think like ourselves. A lot of this is driven by social media. It's driven by this new information environment where we are kind of sent deeper and deeper into our own ideological silos by the algorithms that control the social media. And so we end up only hearing the things that we already agree with. And that has a huge impact on us politically and in terms of our emotions. I also wanted to just briefly answer Gary's point earlier about Deutsche Bank and Donald Trump's finances. It's tempting always to think that Trump's behavior is explained by the financial trouble that he's in. But having written a biography of him and spent many hours with him talking about this stuff, it's very clear that throughout his life, he has had one financial crisis, failure, bankruptcy after another. And everybody around him says the same thing. It's just amazing how little impact it has on him. He manages to sort of sneak out of these things. He's got a 40-year relationship with Deutsche Bank. He has left them hanging again and again and again, and they always come back to him. They always help him out. And that's because it's a longstanding relationship that has done some good for them as well. And so a lot of us would be rattled by the kinds of financial crises that Donald Trump faces again and again, and that he does face in the coming years, but he's not. And so I would not ascribe his behavior to that kind of financial jeopardy that he faces.
Mark wrote the book, Trump Revealed, An American Journey of Ambition, Ego, Money, and Power. And Mark, let me just follow up to that, because the president, he's likable to a lot of people because of his bombast, and he's dislikable for the same reason in a lot of respects. So based on what you learned in researching that book that you put out and then covering him as a journalist, how does he manage to continue to bring so many people into the fold in spite of basically insulting them all?
It's a fabulous question, and it really gets to the core of his appeal and to the core of what makes him so detestable to so many people. And that is that he is, whether you think it's conscious or not, he has an extraordinary knack for reflecting other people's emotions, and especially their darker emotions. And, you know, this is a man who has very little in the way of personal principles, personal values. He's shockingly ignorant about most issues, and yet he has this absolutely extraordinary instinct for hearing what has people riled up and mirroring it back to them. And he does this, whether it's about, you know, a trash pile on the street or a world crisis. It doesn't matter the altitude of the crisis that he's dealing with. But if he sees that you individually or a crowd he's speaking to are upset about something, he's going to absorb that and push it back to you in ever more flowery, not flowery, but extreme language. And that is his gift. Some people hear it and they think it's wonderful. I'm being heard. Someone is taking on my fight. And other people hear it and are appalled. But it is what makes him distinctive. It made him distinctive in the world of real estate, in the celebrity world, and now in the world of politics, where people are just not used to that kind of talent and that kind of methodology.
You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. We are going to get to your phone calls at 513-419-7100 and your emails at talk@wvxu.org. We are talking about the election and the situation in which we find ourselves now for the full hour. We'll be back in just a moment with Mark Fisher from The Washington Post and also with Jason Harrow of Equal Citizens. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We're joined today by Washington Post senior editor Mark Fisher and also by executive director and chief counsel at Equal Citizens, Jason Harrow. We're talking about the election for the full hour, the presidential election, that is. 513-419-7100 is the number to call if you'd like to join us, or email your thoughts to talk@wvxu.org. And Jason, I'd like to bring you back in. We talked moments ago about one of Mark's articles related to Americans' distrust of, quote, the other side. And we also heard the caller's comment about what he sees as a contradiction when someone claims to be patriotic but distrusts the American systems. Well, you're an expert in the judicial process, and I'm wondering what type of mistrust that the American electorate on either side of the ideological divide could be experiencing right now as we head into what could be a very contentious legal battle?
Yeah, you know, that's a great unknown, and it's a great question. Traditionally, the judiciary, in particular the U.S. Supreme Court, but the judiciary in general, have seen higher approval ratings, in part because they're a non-political branch. They're designed to just follow the law, protect constitutional rights. They do not make public appearances frequently. They do not engage in debates in the media. And so they have tended to have trust, and they use that trust, the U.S. Supreme Court did famously in 2000, to resolve a very contested recount. And it was accepted, as Mark mentioned, without violence, and you know, in another country could have led to a real reckoning, and it didn't necessarily. The question is, 20 years later, how much of that trust has been eroded and how much remains? I think that a good amount remains. And in part, that's going to be because the margins here in many states, it looks like, are not going to be in, let's call it, the Florida 2000 zone. Florida in 2000 was decided by 537 votes. When there are so few votes to dispute and it's so close, it's very easy to start manipulating outcomes and become very political as a court. It looks like, though, that Biden has won Wisconsin, where Trump has filed for recount by over 20,000 votes. And that may be the closest of the three main Midwestern states. Well, the average recount flips 240 votes. A Wisconsin recount in 2016 flipped 131 votes for Trump. So the courts are not going to be faced with a situation that is so close where there really could be a recount that flips it. And so I think that they can do a really good job of saying, no, this was the process playing out. Votes take time to count. They take time to canvass and certify. And we can non-politically say there is nothing wrong here, especially because the Trump campaign so far has done a more blustering than producing evidence. If that continues, I think there will surely be, you know, Trump assaulting in the public the courts and the integrity of the system. But I think that will only be bought by a deep minority of people, and the courts will be able to withstand this assault. The long-term damage, there will be long-term damage, but I think in the short run we'll be okay.
And a quick reminder to our listeners who may have heard some promos even at the very top of this hour about what this program would be today. We are fortunate to be joined by Jason Harrow and Mark Fisher today, but we were also expecting to be joined by Ken Rudin, the political junkie. We had an internal technical difficulty that prevented our connection with Ken today, so we do apologize for that, but we are working to reschedule to get Ken on again very soon. 513-419-7100 is the number to call if you'd like to join the conversation. Let's go to the phones now. We have Elena on the line. Hi, Elena. What's your question or comment?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. They were talking earlier about the electorate. Last time with the election with Trump, we had a situation where some electorates were refusing to cast their ballots for Trump, even though their popular vote in their state had dictated that. I'm just wondering, is there a possibility of seeing the same, but in reverse this time, with these outstanding swing states where we're waiting for these to come in? Is there any legal standing where the electorates can say that they disagree with that outcome and cast their ballots in the other direction?
You're asking about the electors who participate in the Electoral College, Elena.
Correct.
Okay, thank you so much. We'll hang up and I'll hand it over to my guest today. Mark, is that something you might be able to help Elena with?
Sure. The electors, I think this has been kind of a longstanding, almost fantasy about threats to our electoral system, the idea of what are known as faithless electors who are, you know, chosen to support one candidate, and then when it comes time to cast their ballot to decide who will be president, they flip and go the other way. This happens extraordinarily rarely in American history. We're talking about one or two times every generation. So it really is not a factor. There have been some court cases on this, but in general, the rule is that they do have to do what their state selects them to do. That process takes place next month after all the ballots are certified by the counties and then by the states in the next week or two. The state legislature legislatures across the country choose those electors, that generally people who are very active in the party were very active in the campaign. They're not going to break with their party. They usually work for their party. So it's really a vanishingly small chance that it happens. When it does, it might be one person. So it's never had an impact on any election.
Let's go back to the phones now. We have Rose up next. Hi, Rose. What's your question or comment?
Yeah, earlier today, this was in NPR, and I heard that the Senate might have to confirm Biden's cabinet. I thought that was very strange. Is that accurate?
I think that that's how it works, but I'll yield to Mark. He's in Washington. Mark?
Right. Yeah, that's all cabinet positions are Senate-confirmed positions, meaning the president nominates the person, and the Senate, through the advice and consent process, holds a hearing, looks into the background of the person, and decides to greenlight them or not. Almost without exception, cabinet members are approved. That's both a courtesy and a reflection of the fact that presidents tend to choose very prominent, well-vetted people for cabinet positions. It's not like some judgeships and some agency heads where that advice and consent process gets a lot more heated and some people do get rejected. I can't think of the last time a cabinet member was rejected. There have been some who, while under that investigation process by Congress, have decided not to go ahead with their candidacy because some dark shadows from their past emerged in that vetting process. So that does happen sometimes where a president says, how about this guy? And the congressional investigators say, well, look at his finances or what happened to some personal problem in the past. And then that candidate may back away. But it usually doesn't get to a very confrontational stage.
There you go, Rose. Thank you for that explanation, Mark, and thank you for the call, Rose. We appreciate it. So I have a guest named Mark. I also have a caller on the line named Mark. So if you're the caller on the line named Mark, hello. What's your question or comment?
Well, a little earlier, I heard a question on the radio program asking where the outrage was, and I submit that you're not necessarily looking in the right place. And I think that for the last 4 years, the majority of voters who did not vote for Trump, who were the majority of voters in America, did not vote for Trump, have been exceedingly patient for the last 4 years with him and the whole thing. Now, there's plenty of outrage there. One example here is took place in Kenosha, Wisconsin. And you look at the number of school shootings and other mass shootings in this country, they are carried out at the hands of young white males with assault rifles going into crowded places. Yet in Kenosha, they let this young white male go into a crowded place with a loaded assault rifle unchecked. Now, I mean, how are we supposed to have faith in a system like that?
Mark, we appreciate the call. Thank you so much. And that was a reference to an email that we had received earlier asking where the outrage was. And we do appreciate the call, Mark. Thank you so much. We'll take another quick phone call now. Let's go to Rainey. Hi, Rainey. What's your question or comment?
Well, earlier in the program, and also thanks, I love Cincinnati Edition.
Thank you.
But earlier in your program, you were asking about how people are feeling through this. It's been such an emotional roller coaster. You know, there's highs and lows, and I'm trying to be patient through all this thing. But what I find most astonishing is that the President of the United States is wanting to take away a fundamental right of people to vote and have their vote counted. It just blows me away. I just don't understand that, why he would go that direction. So anyway, enjoy your program. Hope Ken Rudin gets on too.
Rainey, thank you so much for the call. We're going to make sure that we get Ken Rudin scheduled very soon. We appreciate you listening, and thank you for saying that. I want to get some emails in now at talk@wvxu.org. Mark Fisher from The Washington Post was kind enough to offer us a civics lesson moments ago on the confirmation process for cabinet officials. We've got a similar question, Mark, that I'll allow you to answer, and it's about whether Mitch McConnell will retain his position as Senate leader. This is something that is decided by the parties themselves within those chambers, right, Mark?
Yes, that's right. The other Republican senators get together and choose their own leadership. In McConnell's case, it would be almost unimaginable that they would remove him. The Republicans in the Senate consider him the most effective leader that they have had among themselves for generations. And so whether he is the majority leader or the minority leader, at this point, it looks like he'll retain the majority position. He is almost undoubtedly going to remain at the head of the Republican caucus in the Senate. His colleagues really admire him for his ability to push things through, and perhaps more so for his ability to block opposition initiatives, as he's done so effectively through the Obama presidency and as he's shepherded some of the president's initiatives during this administration. But, you know, Mitch McConnell is a wily and fascinating fellow, and you've seen just in the last 48 hours a little bit of sort of moving away from Donald Trump and talking a little bit about how the votes need to be counted. So there's some real distance there between Republican senators led by McConnell right now and the president, who is embarked on this legal battle that I think very few of his own supporters in Washington are with him on.
And Mark, Mitch McConnell is a villain to a lot of progressive voters and to Democrats, but he's one of those long-serving senators that understands the way the Senate works. And that's also true for Joe Biden, who was in the Senate for a very long time before becoming vice president under Barack Obama. If Joe Biden is to prevail in this presidential election, will divided government work effectively with an old senator in the White House and an old senator running the Senate?
It will have a better shot at producing something than almost any other combination you can think of, short of a one-party control of the entire government. Americans tend to like divided government. They often don't say so, but if you look at their behavior rather than what they say, Americans often choose one party for the White House and the other party for Congress, or at least one House of Congress. So if Biden prevails here and has the Democratic House and a Republican Senate led by someone he's worked with for decades, as you say, Mitch McConnell, there is more of a prospect for some cooperation. Obviously, the Republicans are going to want to push back against the Democrats. There's going to be competition there. There's going to be obstruction of things that they deeply oppose. But I think you'll see progress in some areas, whether it be infrastructure or tax reform or even immigration reform. I think there's a real prospect for progress there because of the relationships and the relational styles of both Biden and McConnell.
I'm going to get some emails now from talk@wvxu.org. Karen wrote in to say, I'm wondering why the mainstream press doesn't call out Trump's authoritarian tendencies. As a serial liar, he's a master propagandist. He tries to subvert the rule of law and now is attempting to prevent all votes from being counted. Never mind that the counting delays in Pennsylvania and Michigan would have been mitigated had the Republican legislators in those states not disallowed counting absentee ballots before Election Day. All of this is straight from the dictator's playbook. And to those Trump supporters who voted for him solely on the economy, maybe they're unaware that Hitler was amazing for the economy. He pulled Germany out of the Depression, built their equivalent of our interstate highway system, no doubt creating many well-paying jobs. That is an email from Karen. We've also got an email from Jane, who writes, how am I feeling about the election? I'm dismayed and saddened to think about the millions of dollars spent on these campaigns. For what? More gridlock? We need to make changes. Term limits, shorter campaigns, more working together, less politics. We've got an email from Aaron, who's asked me to stop repeating the president's tweets. I don't understand why the show is repeating and therefore spreading the baseless rantings of a candidate who cannot tolerate democracy. And an email from Kerry, who says, it's been made clear that Republicans weaponized gerrymandering in 2010. My question is, assuming Republicans keep the Senate and Joe Biden wins the presidency, what would redistricting look like in 2021? How will this change the way our districts look? And how will this change our future elections? We've been talking with Mark Fisher from The Washington Post. We're also joined by Jason Harrow, the executive director and chief counsel at Equal Citizens. And Jason, perhaps I could bring you in for that question, because I imagine there could be legal battles, as there are in the state sometimes, over redistricting.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Unfortunately, the U.S. Supreme Court has said that the federal courts will be out of the business for the coming years of deciding on political gerrymandering claims. What that means is that when state legislatures set the maps, which the Constitution gives states the right to set their own maps for both congressional and state level elections, and it will happen again next year as a result of this 2020 census, that people, plaintiffs who feel disenfranchised cannot, unfortunately, go into federal court and have a federal court say this map is weighted too heavily for one side than the other. That said, there are still legal avenues if people feel that maps are overly gerrymandered. Luckily, in the last decade or so, we've seen a lot of ballot measures, including one that passed in Virginia just a couple of days ago, to set up independent redistricting commissions, right? And put the job of making fair maps in the hands of people who are not themselves benefiting from those maps, which are the existing politicians. That's the better way. So I think there'll be political paths, there'll be legal paths to that. And those structural changes, which another of the emails you read also talked about, including term limits, let me also add to that the idea of potentially abolishing the Electoral College through something called the National Popular Vote. You know, we're seeing the ill effects of the Electoral College because this election would be over already if we didn't have it. Joe Biden is now leading in the National Popular Vote, last time I checked, by over 4 million votes. All of these things, I think, continue to gather momentum, even in this divided government. And maybe, as Mark mentioned, this new era of transactional politics, you know, maybe we'll be fighting tooth and nail over healthcare, but perhaps, just perhaps, we can agree to have some of these anti-corruption measures, lobbying reforms, ethic reforms, gerrymandering reforms. Those are things that are really broadly popular among Democrats and Republicans.
And we're going to get a quick phone call in now from Dan. Hi, Dan. What's your question or comment?
Oh, hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm curious if there's any known impropriety by the Postmaster General. He has a large donor to the Trump campaign, and obviously this election is dependent upon mail-in voting. So I'm just wondering if there's any known impropriety by him.
Dan, thank you so much for the call. Mark, I'll go back to you for this one, because this goes back to what we were talking about earlier, the various distrust, depending on perhaps which side of the political aisle you might find yourself on. Right now, the Postmaster General position has caught the ire of Democrats.
Well, it has. It's also caught the ire of a federal judge here in Washington, Emmett Sullivan, who had ordered the Postal Service earlier this week to move a lot faster on clearing some of the backlogs and getting the mail-in ballots to where they were supposed to be on time. And the Postmaster General and the Post Office defied the judge and said, we're going to do our thing our way and spend our money as we see fit. And that judge is now fit to be tied, has called the Postmaster General back for another hearing, and really wants to call him on the carpet. So that confrontation will continue. And clearly, the Trump administration had attempted to use the Postal Service to diminish the impact, the power of the mail-in ballots that so many Americans turn to in this election cycle. So although it's after the fact and you can't get those ballots to where they're supposed to go after the election, nonetheless, we've not heard the last of that dispute.
And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We're joined today to talk about the presidential election with Washington Post senior editor Mark Fisher. And also with us is Jason Harrow. He's the executive director and chief counsel of Equal Citizens. We've got a few phone calls, but we are short on time. So if you're on the line and I call on you, we got to go kind of quickly so that we can make sure that we get as many of you in as we possibly can. We'll go now to Linda. Hi, Linda. What's your question or comment?
Hi, I have a comment. Well, I have a response to the commentator who mentioned earlier that the political world was taken by surprise by Trump's talent and methodology for just observing what people were thinking or feeling and just instantly reflecting that back. And sitting here thinking about that, I thought the word is really vacuousness. And I think it's really important not to be polite and say things like talent and methodology. Just reflecting back what you see passing across another person's face is vacuous. It's empty. It's not intelligent. It's vacuousness is equated with insanity, even. And I think one of the most important things that we need to do here is change from having an emperor has no clothes situation where people just sit around and clothe what's really happening with polite language.
Linda, thank you so much. We understand your perspective, and thank you so much for calling and sharing it with us. We do appreciate you listening. We'll go now to Bob. Hi, Bob. What's your question or comment?
Okay, I'm more of a positive person. We've had these elections. If you look through history, Adams and Jackson and Jefferson, they all had nasty, nasty elections. Teddy Roosevelt called his opponents nasty names. And I think this is normal, not whatever. But I was a first-time poll worker this year, and Republicans and Democrats in the polls were absolutely fantastic. People stand in line. You could talk to see them talking. One was Democrat, Republican. They were happy and talking. People outside was passing out pamphlets. They sat down, and you could tell them they was telling jokes. I think, for what I see, yes, we're polarized, but, you know, Americans don't get through this. I think, each person is a good person.
Well, Bob, we appreciate you telling us that, and thank you for working the polls, and thank you so much for listening and calling in today. We'll go now to Jonathan. Hi, Jonathan. What's your question or comment?
Hi. My question is about the Electoral College. I know you touched on that a little bit earlier. I'm 38, and, been voting in every election I could since I was 18, and if Biden loses, this will be the third time that I've seen a president or a candidate win the popular vote, but not get the electoral vote. So my question is, why are we still doing this? Like, what is the real reason?
Jonathan, you and I share that in common with being old enough to vote in the same amount of elections and experiencing that same time frame. Thank you so much for asking the question, and thank you very much for listening. And we did talk a little bit about this. We had a guest on, an author of a new book, and the name now escapes me, but basically calling for an end to the Electoral College. Mark, do you think that we'll see more calls for that?
No, I don't think so. It's kind of an old chestnut. People like to complain about the Electoral College when it goes against their interests. They're just fine with it when it goes their way. The Electoral College is really at the core of what it means to be American, what our Constitution is about. It's about protecting minority rights. And that was the central concern of the founders. That's why they established the Electoral College, so that small states, rural states, places that would not that were unlikely to gain majority control could still have a significant voice. That's why we have the Senate, not just the House of Representatives, to represent all states equally, whether they have small populations or large, whether they have rural populations or urban ones. And so that's the purpose of the Electoral College. And I don't think it's going away because depending on the era, it benefits one party or the other back and forth. So I don't see a groundswell on that.
Can
I just interrupt quickly?
Of course, Jason, please.
Because I've done a lot of work on the Electoral College. I just want to make 2 points. The first is I want to direct the listener, because they asked about changing this crazy system we have, to the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact, which is a way of having a national popular vote through the Electoral College by requiring states to award their presidential electors to the candidate who wins the most national votes rather than just the votes in the state. That compact has actually been remarkably successful, and states with 196 electoral votes out of the needed 270 have actually agreed to it already, including Colorado, which just on Tuesday voted in the first time in a public referendum to continue to adopt that method. So in the next couple of years, including in a place like Ohio, if we continue to make progress there, we actually can change the system without amending the Constitution, and there really has been meaningful bipartisan progress on this issue. It's passed the House in Oklahoma. It's passed the House in Arizona. And the second part is just the origin of the Electoral College. It's really not, just to disagree gently with Mark, the main concern of the founders, if you look back at the debates in 1787, was that there was no national media. There was no WashingtonPost.com, which makes it so wonderfully easy for folks across the country to understand what's going on politically. So they had to figure out a way to elect folks by state rather than have a national popular vote, in addition, of course, to the slavery issue, which was, gave rise to so many of these things. Those are outdated now. We do have a national election, and thankfully, slavery has been abolished. We have a one-person, one-vote principle. So the reasons that the Electoral College was created are no longer relevant, and there really are ways forward. It doesn't do much protecting now. It just makes some votes count more than others based on where they're cast, not small or large size. So I think this decade could see a change.
And that book I referenced was Let the People Pick the President by Jesse Wegman. And you can listen to that interview at WVXU.org inside the Cincinnati Edition tab. My guests today have been Mark Fisher of The Washington Post and Jason Harrow of Equal Citizens. I've so enjoyed both your company today. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We'll talk tomorrow.